Hey, listeners, this week I've been busy stuffing envelopes with the new Evan Rad Snowboard podcast stickers, sending them out to all the listeners who bought tickets to the last Wired Snowboard raffle. If you paid by PayPal, I probably have your address. Those of you who e-transferred me need to send your address to evanradpodcast@hotmail.com. Thank you all for supporting the show. I'm excited to bring the listeners of the Evan Rad Snowboard podcast a brand new podcast series from past guest and fan favorite Russell Winfield, who's also the very first African-American professional snowboarder. Obviously, it's more important now than ever to listen, learn, take action, and amplify Black voices so that everyone can do their part to right the centuries of racism in this part of the world. The snowboard community needs to be a part of this change. Russell's first guest, Salema Masekela, is an American television host, sports commentator, actor, singer, and activist. His nonprofit, Stoked, works to close the opportunity gap through mentorship and action sports culture, empowering underserved youth to reach their fullest potential, instilling passion, resilience, and determination through skateboarding, surfing, and snowboarding. Wired Snowboards has donated a snowboard, and Tribute Board Shop sent over a new art collab hoodie for us to raffle, with 100% of the money raised getting donated to Stoked. Plus, our great friends at Vans will be matching the first $2,000 we raise, so potentially all your donations will be doubled. For every $10 you donate, you get your name in the hat for the Wired board and the hoodie, with no limit on how much you can donate or how many tickets you can buy. I'll do the draw at the end of the series. So with that being said, I'm handing the microphone to Russell Winfield, who I want to thank from the bottom of my heart for bringing these incredible conversations into the snowboard community. Let's listen together.
Hello, this is Russell Winfield, and welcome to The Plug. It's my new podcast. Basically, what's going to happen is it's going to have conversations with different people about different life experiences. Hopefully, it's something that somebody out there can learn from, maybe giggle from. Enjoy it. Thank you. In the premiere episode of The Plug, I'm going to be speaking with the longtime homie brother from another mother, Salema Masekela. We're going to speak about, you know, his childhood growing up on both coasts, the differences. We're going to speak about, you know, adulthood a little bit. We're going to speak about the current state of affairs. Have a listen.
Is everybody here?
Yeah.
Perfect. All right. How you been, man?
I've been interesting. Like, I've been interesting. It's been the most interesting few weeks on top of few months that I can remember in life.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. Like, is this going to be our, you know, revolution for our generation? Or, I don't know. I mean, I'm just a cynical individual at this point in my life, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, listen, as Black men in America that have grown up as Black boys in America, taught the history of what was fought for, witness the battles of what we were fighting for as young youth of the 90s, seeing the riots, seeing police brutality, seeing the effects of not only seeing, but like literally like learning how to operate and navigate through systemic racism in spaces where we repeatedly find ourselves as the only people who look like us. There's definitely like context to be cynical. That said, and I think, you know, like we talked about the other day, I'm operating on a sliver of hope. Like I fell off the back of a boat in the middle of the night. I didn't get eaten by sharks, but I'm still scared for my life. But there happens to be a dinghy that I'm swimming to that looks like it might be stable.
Might not be taking on water.
It might not be taking on water, and there may or may not be a quart of fresh water on it. I'm not sure, but I'm swimming in that direction, and I'm hopeful.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You said something that I think I know the answer to, but I'm not sure. I'm about 90%. You said we grew up as Black boys, which we did. You know, we're not chameleons. We've been this color. We're going to be this color. And it's beautiful. So I know I grew up. And another thing you said around, like, we were the only, I was the only one. Mm. I, you grew up in San Diego and a bit in New York, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what was your experience as a kid like?
Well, I was really, really spoiled. And I say spoiled in that, like, I got a really special set of tools and experience growing up in New York City.
Yep.
You know, I grew up in the Shaolin. I went to school with Method Men. We were classmates from elementary school through junior high. If you look at my school pictures, it was Black people and Russian kids. And kids whose parents had fled the conflict in the Czech Republic. Okay. It was Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, Italians, Jews, African immigrants. It was everybody. Like,
so what you're telling me is the most foreign person to you at that age would have been someone from Middle America.
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing.
The most foreign, you could not have put that any more succinctly and right center dead of target. The most foreign person to me growing up until I was about 14, 15 would have been someone from Middle America. And because of growing up that way and learning everybody's culture, knowing everybody's food, knowing their holidays, learning their history, understanding the nuance, their music, their songs, their dress, knowing the nuances of what made people who they were culturally.
You're a cultural giant by the time you stepped out of eighth grade.
Absolutely.
Basically. And it's absolutely funny. I grew up no more than 40 miles from you. And my experience was, let me back up. New York in itself is one of the craziest places on the planet because it's got literally everything. Like where you grew up, you know, it's got full country. It's got where I grew up, which is like the wealthiest part of the planet when I was growing up. Like the Bushes are from my town. So the people I was around were like the people who are running the country now. And it's just, it's like, I was lucky I was able to get that education. You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
So that's how I did it. My mom from Durham, North Carolina, decided she didn't want me growing up in the hood. So that's where I was brought up.
Yeah. It's interesting, crazy how, like, how much landscape exists inside of these quote-unquote borders of a place like New York. But then my mother and stepfather moved to New England.
Oh.
When I was almost in my freshman year of high school.
Wow, and where'd you go?
A little small town called Attleboro that was like a lunch pail, everybody wore work boots.
Yep.
Type town, high school of I went to a few different high schools in and around New England. I went to in Cumberland, Rhode Island, Attleboro, Rhode Island, and Norton, Rhode Island. And I was Han Solo Negro.
Oh.
That began the beginning of
the re-education of Salema Massacre.
Yeah. big time. In being the only Black kid. You know, and I would still take advantage of the fact that my father lived in New York City. And when he wasn't traveling, making music, I would go and stay with him. So I could still dip in, right, and get my flavoring. But it was two different complete existences and learning how to navigate being everybody's one Black friend.
Yeah. And what that meant, really.
Yeah. And it was a lot. It was a lot. It was outright racism. You know, you knew whose kids, you knew whose parents were like real high quality racist by the way they treated you.
Yeah.
And then it was, you know, a few years later, moving to Carlsbad, San Diego, when I was almost 17, like at the end of my junior year of high school, And then he was like, here we go again, but like a different version and a different planet of it, where, again, you move to a town where now everyone's blonde hair, blue eyed, and hardly wearing any clothes and speaking like in dude and bro. And, you know, they're looking at me like I moved from another planet. And it was the same thing when I moved to New England. I remember when I moved to New England, a kid being like, yeah, you're from New York. You carry a knife or a gun. You ever seen anybody get killed?
Huh?
Then it'd be like, you do a head spin. Do a windmill. Hey, who's that kid? I think he knows how to do that breakdance and stuff. And people being like, dance, come on, dance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And moving to SoCal was a similar type deal, but just a different framework of it. But luckily, you know, it was a place where surfing and skateboarding and snowboarding were the thing that bounded it together. And I was just like, I knew how to adapt. And I was like, all right, this is what you do to be cool. I'm going to try that. And fortunately, fell in love. I caught the spirit, and I was like, oh, this is next level. I can navigate this.
Yep. So that's crazy. So I remember coming from the East Coast to San Diego when I was 18, and that to me was the most culture shock that I've ever. Let me back that up. The most off-guard version of culture shock I've ever felt in my life. Like,
same.
And anywhere. Like, it was just coming from New York City to Pacific Beach. I remember waking up one Sunday morning at, like, 7, and all I wanted was an egg sandwich, you know? It was, like, 7 in the morning, Sunday. It's got to be a deli. So I walked up and down Garnett Avenue for, like, 2 hours, and it was crickets. I was like, where am I? You know, I mean, on top of being
Han Solo Negro.
Yeah. I mean, I remember my parents, I had this nice little green Volkswagen. I'd been in town like 3 days, bro. And it was the middle of the day. I was in Pacific Beach and I pulled over to go into a, get some food or something. And the cop just blocked me in. Whose car is that? My car. What do you mean? You know, it's like my car, officer. You know,
I try to explain to people what we learned to go through as kids when it was never like license and registration, please. How are you today? Do you understand why I pulled you over? I was like, yeah, that's on TV.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for us, it was always like, is this your vehicle?
Yeah, and you better be polite in answering. I mean, you know that it's my fucking car was what was in my head. It's my car, officer, what came out of my mouth. Because if not, I would have got fucking shot or dragged or who knows.
God forbid you said that with any sort of tone.
Oh, yeah. No. It was very submissive. And it kills me to have to do that to this day.
Yeah.
That's still the way I got to talk to him.
Of course. I mean, every time I get ready to leave the house, even now at 48 years old,
I run through
the checklist. Where is everything? My registration is not in my glove box. My registration and insurance are in the visor, mm-hmm. above. I got my phone set on its holder so that it's facing in the direction of anyone who comes to the car so I can put that video in motion. And, you know, hands at 10 and 2, window down, and make sure that I don't pull over ever in a place that's secluded. I will throw my hazard lights on and drive at 15 miles an hour, and I will take them someplace where there's going to be people.
Yeah.
And that's just, that's the rule.
Yeah. But as we see, that don't even matter no more.
Right. Maybe, and that's not a guarantee. Now, yeah, you're right. Like, that's not a guarantee. That's just trying to at least put some odds. On the situation.
Yeah, exactly. Better your odds of not getting. Well, yeah, I mean, that's just, and as a good segue, that's when my friends have been calling me, asking me how I am, I'm, you know, we talked a little bit about this.
Mm.
I'm the same as I was a month ago.
Mm.
It's, you know, like you said, I have a sliver of hope, but I'm personally not any different. We move the way we move. What saddens me is that it's normal for us. Like at this point, it's just, I've accepted that this is the way that I need to move. Do I like it? Not necessarily, you know, but it's a survival tactic.
It is. It's like COVID, you know, during the height of the lockdown, you didn't see black or brown people or people who are like born of struggle out protesting that they had to either stay home or wear a mask. It was just another thing to add to the list of limitations to navigate existence. So it's like, all right, we're going to figure out how to pivot and be resourceful. Like, this is what we are used to. Just another thing that we're being told we have to do. And it was interesting to see, like, the first people who were out, you know, and violently protesting that their rights were being infringed upon. And even when I started to hear the word oppressed, I was like, wow. You know, when
now
I
these
see,
are
like,
people who are making more money on unemployment than they were before while working.
I'm like, you're oppressed? Please tell me more about this new oppression. I just found the language fascinating, and I found it interesting that people who'd never been uncomfortable before for a consistent period of time being forced to be uncomfortable for a couple of months, like,
let's unravel people's
existence.
I can't even say uncomfortable. Not being able to get a haircut and being paid to stay at home. Not all of them, but most people were being paid. I knew a lot of people who weren't working and who were making more.
Right.
You know, I got laid off for 12 hours. I filed for unemployment. They told me no. Thank God we were deemed essential so I could work. But, you know, it's like, because you can't get a haircut and someone's telling you that the bar's closed, you're going to stand at the Capitol with an automatic rifle? Let's talk about that. You hear me? Let's talk about that.
Oh, man. I'm not going to lie, bro. I laughed at my television. It was a form of entertainment in the darkness. Like, when
that
was the worst, I was just like, thank you for giving me at least a little bit of levity in this uncertain, unprecedented situation. But, you know,
I guess it's relative. Not really, but I mean, what do you say to someone who is dead set on being thinking that they're oppressed? Because what was the other sign? I want to get a massage or something like that, that they were showing all over the news.
Yeah.
I need a massage and a haircut.
All right, cool. Listen, I also think that those people are immune to, I don't think anybody can be changed. Like,
I'm with you.
People have to find an awakening and some calling of empathy within themselves in how they witness others, et cetera, to feel compelled to make change. You know this. You've made massive changes in your life more than once, and nobody changed you.
No.
You made that definitive choice. Yep. So when I see people like that, I'm just like, I feel for them, but I can't give them my energy because I want to be about the people who are open to growth and change, and who don't see change as something that's against them, but see the potential of what's on the other side to be better as a result of change. And that, coming back around to what you said, that's the one thing that gives me a little bit of hope. As much as it's frustrating to get all the text messages from our well-meaning white friends letting us know that they care about us or they finally get it, or want to know how we're doing, I'm like, all right, well, at least it seems like y'all want to do the homework now, and you'd like to pay attention, and you realize that this thing that you thought you could just feel bad for us about is actually something that you can make a difference in, and also low-key you've been participating even though you didn't know you were.
You are, come on, bro. You know. Whether or not you know, you know. Like, me, you, and a white dude are standing at a bar, and we walk outside, and there's a cop. He comes up to me and you and doesn't even acknowledge the white person. Mm-hmm. You're telling me that white person doesn't know? And I mean, I can't blame him, because if the cop didn't come up and acknowledge me, you know?
Mm.
Maybe I would, but I don't know, because I've never had that. So I'm, you know?
I think that from like an entertainment standpoint, and the way kids are raised to view two things. One, the like on a pedestal until they just on a pedestal from jump, being like what the definition of the police are, is a exalted higher power. It's not like, hey, these are our public servants that we pay to take care of us. It's immediately like, it's just hero status, right? And then the images that people are fed when it comes to blackness in America, and especially black males, is that if, whether it be in television shows, dramas, years and years of what having watched cops, the news and the manner in which they talk about us from a criminal standpoint, is people get conditioned into thinking like, well, I know the good ones. And obviously those people who something bad happened to, at the hands of the police or what I think is happening in their neighborhoods, like that's just who they are. And people get conditioned to the idea of like, they must have deserved it, but they're different from these people, these black people, my black friends. And they find some sort of weird safety in that conditioning that you've been told your whole life is the case, which is why I don't expect any of this shit to end overnight. I understand why people are freaked out at the concept that the police could be a gang.
Could be.
I'm giving them the benefit of, I'm speaking from their perspective. Like,
yeah,
the idea that that's a gang and that someone might go in with really good intentions of upholding the law and being an actual agent of change and safety in their neighborhood, and then once they're in the gang, and the gang is like, yo, listen, you need to fall back with all that rah-rah superhero. That's not how we get down here. We are all for one, one for all, and if you call one of us out, you're a rat or a snitch, and we're going to make your life live in hell. Then suddenly that kid who might have had good intentions tries to be indifferent for a while, and then he's just like, you know what, fuck it. Let me join in with this shit. And that's what happens.
You either got to join in or you got to leave the whole town. Because if you quit, they're fucking with you. Now you're black. Right.
Not to mention if you're, you know, if you're one of the 11% of black officers.
You're getting it on just, both sides, though.
They're getting it on both sides.
You're getting it from the,
And you're getting it from the force every day that you walk into that locker room.
Yeah, and you're getting it from the hood. So that, you know, I don't envy any black person that wants to go into law enforcement. I really don't, because that's...
I admire them for wanting to be a part of change. But then I've all, at the same time, you see how even they can succumb and find themselves agents of the thing. You see it all the time. So I don't know, man. I think it is my hope that eventually we can get to the place where people understand that the culture of the thing is what needs to change. I'm not against the idea of the people being there to protect and serve, if that's what they're there to do. But, you know, you and I can honestly say that our experiences of feeling protected and served are not there. The only times that I've had to beg for my life, only times I've had to physically beg for my life on the other side of a policeman's gun. And that's been more than once. That shit is traumatizing. I've been the kid sitting in handcuffs for an hour as the cops trying to figure out whether or not I'm legitimately the black boy that is the janitor that cleans car dealerships in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And had the shotguns drawn on me and the whole nine, and literally like begged them not to kill me.
Oh, yeah.
In reading a magazine in 7-Eleven with my friends, and we're the only two black people in there, and have the store owner be suspect that we've been in there too long, which is what we always used to do reading magazines. And next, you know, the cops show up and there's guns to our temples. And the cop literally saying, like, if you move, I will fucking kill you.
Yeah.
Like, wait a second.
You know, driving through a white neighborhood and to go and see friends and getting pulled over and having all your paperwork right. And then the cop being like, well, why are you here? Excuse me?
Why are you here? They don't like you either, these rich people. You know what would be an amazing show? Would be the dialogue of a black person getting, you know, the inner dialogue of a black person being pulled over by the cops. And just, you know.
The heart rate meter, all of it. All of it. As soon as the lights heat up and you start to sweat and your pulse skyrockets and your heartbeat is through the roof and you ain't done, you haven't done anything. And you actually have shit in order.
Yeah. I got my L's, my I's, as they say in the hood. I got L's and I's. I got it all. I'm good. Not riding dirty. Let's go. And then they pull you over and you're like, well, they, you know, you don't know what they might have or want or who knows.
Yeah.
As I get older, it's been better. Like in my 20s, it was, you know, if I saw a cop and I was in a car, chances are he would pull me over.
Yeah, I remember those days where it was just like, he's going to turn around.
Yeah.
He's going to turn around.
White friends would be like, no way.
There he goes.
Ooh, and here we go.
Game of friends being like, watch this. They're like, what? The cop's going to turn around. No, he's going to turn around. And there we go.
There we go. I mean, granted, they might have had more, you know, reason when I was in my 20s, but still, I, you know, there was way worse people than me driving around.
And that's the thing. It's like, young people make mistakes all the time.
Yeah.
A friend of mine sent me a thread, too, of this white woman who talked about all the things she did as a kid that she never got arrested
for. I saw that. Beating people up.
At the party.
Knocking people out in front of cops.
Shoplifting.
Thousands of dollars of stuff, Sal.
And just having to return it and all these other things. And I was just like, she gave literally, like, I was fucked up from 16 to 20, whatever, before I got my shit together. And fortunately, they treated it as such. And that was my privilege. And now I'm mad successful.
Yeah. You know how many felonies that would have been?
Oh, my goodness.
In the 80s in California, you would have struck out. You would have been locked up for life.
Would have been a wrap.
Yep. Yeah. Geo. Gang.
But all that said, hopeful at this time.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit. I mean, we're kind of in and out of it about the current state of affairs. As much as you want to talk about it, you know, and do you feel that the current administration has spurred? Because to me, it seems like, and this might sound really messed up, but fuck, George Bush doesn't seem like such a bad dude no more to me. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm just being real with you, bro.
If you ever wanted to see, like, a classic example of the efficiency of how the system of white supremacy works, white people don't freak out, we're not targeting you. The system of white supremacy works, making that statement to be like, you know what? Yeah, Bush was a superhero compared to this situation. which is such a crazy thing to be able to say. But
did you ever? Never.
Never in a million years. Never in a million years. And but I think it's the totality of the unintelligence and the celebrating of not being intelligent, the celebrating of casting wisdom aside, literally like demeaning people, like being quote unquote intellectual is the new thing to be able to poke fun at. And God forbid you like come out with receipts and history to give context to situations. It's fake news. And this I don't even like to say president because it's just a wild ass concept.
No,
but
not, yeah.
This man who occupies the office, being the greatest fake it till you make it person in history, and now faking it, like, which was semi entertaining when he was in business with, you know,
unless you were in business with him or trying
unless
to work
business
for him.
With, like I said, semi.
Yes.
But not entertaining now when it literally affects people's lives and
the whole planet.
The whole planet. And when amplifying and pouring the flames on the worst parts of America's DNA is the thing that props you up as a golden guy. Because let's face it, you got your like straight up outright racist.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have those people who are like,
the fringe ones?
I don't agree with how he talks about it, but he speaks his mind and he makes some good points.
Here's the thing. If you are down for him, you are a racist and a sexist and a homophobe. And that's it.
You're either that or you're down to prop up the systems.
Well,
that
if you're down
that.
To prop it up, then you're part of it, so you're down for it.
100%.
Like just strip it all the way down, and the good thing is that if this ends, you've exposed yourself, and now I see you, and you can't take that back.
I love that they're all out in the sunlight.
Yeah,
and that's the one thing that I never thought I'd say grateful for, but the one gift in this administration is that Donald Trump isn't a cause of the emotions and the ignorance and the hate. He's just a symptom of what's already existed, and it's provided a platform and a safe space for people to really feel like they can be out here in these streets with noble and novel ideas of returning back to a time when just simply being white was enough and everyone else should figure out how to fall in line, because this is a white Christian American country in those people's mind's eye. And as they see the numbers of brown people climbing and, you know, positions of power starting to have true inclusion and diversity, if your identity, like if your cultural identity is just being an American and being white, you definitely would be threatened as fuck if that's how you identify. The whiteness is a construct, right? It's not a real thing. But it's a construct to make people traditionally through the history of our country feel more important than everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but in their mind's eye, it feels really good. Like when you're playing the game, like I'm killing it. And that's the biggest like sort of duping that of this type of racism and this type of insidious like divisiveness. It's like those people who feel comfortable now to be out in the streets railing against, you know, black people and Muslims and the LGBTQ community and anyone who's not them, they're not even getting anything for it, Russell.
No. But that's like how it all, isn't that how it started? Like the rich, rich white dudes were like, I ain't giving you no money, but at least you ain't black, you know?
Exactly. And that's exactly what happened.
When and then they like clung to that. They're like, I'm poor, but I'm white.
There was a time when slavery ended that you had poor white indentured servants and slaves.
Yep.
And they became homies and were down for each other. And once the system sort of realized that, like, oh shit, that's a problem, because they got allies, they just gave a little bit more to the white people. They gave that 40 acres and a mule to those white people and told them, actually, I know you work side by side with them and sweated together and had these bonds, but you're better. So here you go.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a power move. And I'm not, you know, it's not some shit that I'm making up. You just got to, you know, Google your history and learn. And that's the other thing about where we're at right now is that a lot of the people who are incredulous about how we've gotten to this place or that it can't be real, it's like, you are the beneficiaries of really, really shitty education. That's the benefit.
And it's getting worse.
And it unfortunately continues to get worse.
Hey, I got an idea. Let's take all creativity out of school.
Mm.
Hey, I got an idea. Let's just throw teachers in there willy-nilly. Hey, I got an idea. Let's just have standardized classes.
Antiquated.
Yeah.
Antiquated systems that just that don't have any relevance to right now. Which is, again, why, as much as we're shit-talking right now, I am hopeful. Because if there's anything that the COVID situation has done, and then you throw in on the back end the largest global civil rights movement of our time, it is a blacklight on any systems that don't work. And
yeah.
I think it's why people are trying to, like, even from a corporate side, people are calling me all day.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we want to change the culture of our brand. We want to figure out what we've been doing wrong and how to do it right. Never thought that. Usually people could just be quiet. And is it over? Okay, we'll get back to business as usual. But it's the first time that people realize that that might hit me in the pocketbook. So I want to make some changes.
Yeah.
And I don't really care the reasoning at this point, but if we can get your activity and get your power and the ability to sort of influence at a DNA level, and you're deciding that, like, being anti-racist is valuable to you, more power to you.
Yeah. Whatever it takes, you know. It's a lot, Slim. It's a lot.
Yeah. When I think back to you and I meeting, shit, now it's 25 years, you know.
Before that.
Yeah, it's more than that. It's like
93.
Yeah, it's just.
Transworld or something?
Yeah, Transworld. Yeah, I don't know if I think I've told you this story before, but, like, you had a 2-page spread. I think you're on the Fat Albert board doing a board slide.
Yeah.
Remember that one?
Uh-huh.
Maybe Foster took it?
Dano or Trevor Griggs, depending on
okay.
One.
But it was iconic. It was, like,
yeah.
An iconic photo. In an iconic photo issue, and that was the first time that I saw a black snowboarder. And I just remember opening up the magazine. I hadn't seen a video part of you yet, and just being like, I worked at Transworld at the time, and I was like, yo,
just fist pumping, proverbially.
Literally, I was like, people, I probably, like, yelled in the inside of Transworld, being like, yo.
Yeah.
You see this? And people be like, yeah, we know who that is. It was the biggest moment for me. I cut them out, spread out carefully with an X-Acto knife, taped it together, and put it up in my cube. 5-6 years later, you know, we end up in a situation where we're working together, and you come to be a part of a company that I started. And that was the first thing I said, is like, we're getting Russell Winfield. But it was such a huge thing for me to keep going. Try to figure out and make my way in snowboarding, like seeing you.
Okay, there's one, so it's going to be a little, you know, like the door has opened.
But seeing you was like seeing 1,000 people. Like that one image might as well been there's 1,000 black snowboarders on the planet.
Yeah,
and I'm going to keep going.
Shit, it's powerful. You know. I wish as a 18-year-old, 19-year-old kid, I had the wisdom that I do now. I didn't. It just didn't. That whole thing didn't click with me, you know? Like, it did, but it was on such a selfish and personal level that I don't know. We always look back and could have done more, could have done better. But
you were dealing with your own coming-of-age struggles.
Yeah.
And I think that from the outside looking in, I think knowing the power that you really had was petrifying.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was much easier to be like the biggest guy in the room having the most fun than, you know what I mean? Like, that was a dangerous time to have that. I don't know how I would have won it. It was hard enough being like just coming up in the trenches like from the industry side as an only. I couldn't imagine being the only.
It was cool, but it was kind of, I don't know. It was, it was brutal, bro. It just didn't, nothing really fits right ever for me, you know, like there's always, and it maybe that's everybody on the planet, you know, but being in that or in any sport where you're the only one or any situation where you're the only one, it's just, it's kind of a lot, man. You know,
it's a lot. And people are just, I think people are just now beginning to get that. Thus you get the hey man, I'm checking in on you. How are you doing? Like more than I've gotten long text messages from people being like, I never ever stopped to even begin to think what it was like in your shoes for the last 25 years, because I considered myself special and righteous for choosing not to see your color.
Come on, bro. Nobody is colorblind. It's not, and that's not what we want. That's not what I want.
No, and that's my point. The people being like, that was about me and not you, and it was selfish, and it allowed me not to have to even like stop to think about any of the shit that you were going through. One of my best friends for many years literally called me up in tears and was like, I'm sorry. Never would have expected to hear that from me. I'm sorry. I was oblivious, and I didn't stand up for you because I didn't know you needed it. I chose not to see that you needed it.
Yeah, there you go. I'm hyped that people are coming around, and I really do hope that this spurs a change, you know. The difference between now and the one of Gil Scott-Heron is the motherfucking revolution is televised, and it's on the gram, and it's being tweeted, and it's on the book. You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
And from recent, you know, events, it seems as though in order for somebody to believe something, you have to beat it into their head with imagery, a lot.
Gruesome imagery. You and I talked the other day on the phone, I may have said this to you, but I said, if George Floyd had gotten shot, I don't think we would even be in this situation, because people are used to being able to justify black men being shot.
Yeah.
It's like America is like down for guns like that.
Oh, yeah.
But they had to witness like a straight up old fashioned
lynching,
like a real execution lynching, like in the old days, the way people used to gather around, and be like, what are you doing Saturday? Oh, we're going to bring the kids down to the lynching. You know, they found that one nigga that was, you know, stole some apples or whatever, or looked at me such and such the wrong way. You're gonna be, what time? 1 o'clock?
Bring the sweet tea.
Yeah, tell the missus to bring that sweet tea. Woo! That's the best. It's gonna be hot.
Oh my god.
They had to witness like a condensed version of that in the 8 minutes and 46 seconds of George Floyd, where they could watch the life leave a man's body and hear him emote and beg in a manner that you can't comprehend of what it might be like negotiating the space between here and I'm going to be entering the afterlife, going from begging for his life to calling for his mama, while a crowd of people behind the camera are begging for these men that happen to have these uniforms on, hands in their pockets, calm face, administering the execution. All of those layers and the time of it and the fact that, like, people didn't have any place to hide in this time of COVID to witness and appreciate it.
Oh, they were all stuck to their phones and TV, so they had no choice.
No choice. And that's why it's hitting different. Crazy.
It is crazy. Current state of affairs is next level. Do you have any thoughts? I know you do, on I hate to say a solution, but an outcome, any hopes, any hope not. Like, let's say 4 years down the road, or 10, let's just go even 10.
Man. Listen, you know me. I always been the one to err on the side of love. And it is my hope that love truly does reign supreme and is the ultimate power, and that in some way, shape, or form, it will become something that people are proud to carry with them more than carrying a firearm, more than carrying some fake idea of importance based on bloodline or melanin or lack thereof. And I don't know, when I look down the line 10 years, it is my hope that we are more loving as a society and of compassion and empathy. And those in power applying compassion to what our laws look like, people being encouraged to want to do the work, just to solve problems from a place of truly seeing, accepting, and acknowledging each other, instead of trying to live in these hard lines of the sand of like, either you're going to my way or you're not a thing. I would like to see 10 years from now, if you're talking about tolerance, people looking at you like, tolerance. We don't got no time for tolerance. We do have a time for acceptance, allowance, and acknowledgement. I would like those to be cultural themes 10 years from now. And do I think that that's going to happen from a like a top-down level?
Yeah.
No.
Bottom up.
That has to happen from the bottom up, and not even thinking of the bottom as being the bottom, but actually switching the roles and people realizing that we as a collective, as humanity, is all connected. Like, we are the top.
Mm-hmm.
And those few that are in power, that actually is the bottom. Like, flipping the script and understanding like where true power lies in the collective of community, and the ability to shift consciousness as a collective.
Mm-hmm.
It might sound like pie in the sky, but like that's the energy that I'm working in, because everything else is like kind of zero outcome. So that's where it is for me. Do I hope that we can someday go away from a two-party system and get to more? Sure, absolutely. But in the meantime, I'm going to do everything I can at a local level to affect what I can within my community with that energy of love and, you know, obviously the power of the vote.
Yeah. Like you, I'm more of a MLK Jr. than a Malcolm X individual.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems like the other side just wants to fight and they're ready to fight. And it's like, fighting's not... I mean, if it comes down to the come down, fine. Let's go. But that's
right.
Not, you know...
None of us are waking up hoping that shit pops off.
No.
Well, I want to live this life. Dude, you're a father.
Yeah.
You got beautiful daughters that, you know, you want to see flourish, etc., which is what all of us have commonly.
Yeah. It's next level right now. But I think there is hope, like you were saying. And I think the solution is that people just need to realize that they just need to be good.
Mm.
Just be good. You know when you're doing good and you know when you're doing bad. Just do good.
It takes a lot more effort to be in that energy of hate and conflict than it is to want to simply do good to yourself and others. And I think that the hate that you see, the people who are lined up ready to fight, bro, they're petrified. That is the highest manifestation of fear energy that you will ever see. And it's going to sound weird to say, but my heart breaks for those people. Like, I feel for those people, because I couldn't imagine what it would be like to be consumed with that much fear to the point where it's converted into this 24/7, like, that hate is the hill that you want to die on.
Yeah. Because you believe you're dying for a cause. It's crazy.
A cause it's rooted and built solely in fear. Like, yeah, that's a shitty existence.
Yeah, it's got to be exhausting.
Because this shit over here is exhausting. So that shit has to be. It has to be. Exhausting.
Has to be. Yeah, I can't even imagine. I know. For me, this whole defund the police department, I'm down. Like, I'm down to shift some money around. You know what I'm saying? The one thing that I wonder about, all these racist police officers, are they going to all turn into some crazy militia that we're going to have to deal with? Which is, it is what it is. You know, every country has its terrorist groups, I guess. You know, that's where my brain kind of goes. Like, didn't a town, when they fired one of their cops, didn't 57% of their force quit?
That was in Buffalo there, where the cops that got fired for pushing the 75-year-old man down, who is currently still in the hospital and can't walk, and they didn't attend to him. 57 mm-hmm. police resigned from that particular part of the force, like first responders, whatever, in the streets, and rallied by their side and decided they're going to do something else in the force. Which just goes back to show, like, that collective energy of, like, of the mentality. Like, if your sole identity is in your uniform, that's the thing to me. Like, oh, you become a policeman, policewoman, are you no longer a citizen first? Are you no longer one of us first? How did we let that happen?
People search for identities. Like, do I snowboard? Yeah. Is that who I am? No.
Yeah.
That's part of who I am.
I love surfing, but I'm not a surfer.
Yeah. You know, it's
Love surfing. I love snowboarding. Like, and when I speak about it, it's like you're talking about. Talk about the love of the thing. Yeah. Not that I am it.
Yeah. I love the whole, our culture of it. And not the black snowboard culture, the snowboard culture.
Yeah.
That's what I hope, is that we recognize and realize there are different shades of color, but we're all the same race. Like, I was talking to Spencer, and when Eric was like, Sal, I was like, yes. He was like, Kira, I was like, yes. He was like, Stevie, I was like, yes. And then he was like, Spencer, and I was like, Spencer? Spencer O'Brien? He was like, yes, she's Native. And I was like, whoa, interesting. I had to think about it, and I called him back, and I was like, yeah, I'm in. We need allies, you know? We all need to be allies. And I called you on it too. Called you and talked to you about her. And I was like, what do you, you were like, yeah. I was like, yeah, you're right, man. And that was like, that's my programming.
Yeah. And what's dope about her is she's like never been afraid in the midst of, listen, snowboarding has always been safe to stay on the sidelines of any of these issues, straight up. Like, yeah. Snowboarding is about the lifestyle, et cetera. Like, don't rock the boat. Spencer O'Brien, she's someone who's always, Spencer O'Brien first, this is what I come from first, this is what I believe. Also, I ride snowboards. And the idea that, like, because you do a sport, you suddenly, like, this culture that you're in is now, like, 100% unaffected by what goes on in the world, that's ludicrous.
Yeah.
It's having allies, and it's having people realize that, yes, outside of this thing that I do, these are the things that happen in the world. I can also, like, feel free to, like, talk about what I believe in and stand for. And create, you know, connection and empathy for others. That seems pretty straight up like part of what the feeling of snowboarding is. It should naturally fit and segue.
It does, but I just think that there wasn't enough color in snowboarding. If you don't make somebody do something, they ain't gonna do it. Well, you know what I'm saying? Like, if they're not seeing it, snowboarding didn't see. Unless you're hanging out with me or you or Iman or one of the three or four black people in the industry, you know, Stevie, Keir, you weren't seeing the way the police treated you. You don't see it, out of sight, out of mind.
Mm.
You know? It's not an excuse.
It's not. But like, they didn't stand in the lift lines with us and endure the ridicule.
Yeah.
And endure the laughing. Endure the what are you doing here? Yeah. And the people who thought it was cool or funny to repetitively ask a question or tell you that you didn't belong. They didn't endure or hear any of that stuff for the entirety of their growing up doing the thing that they loved. They just went and they did it and had a blast.
Yep.
They didn't sit behind their goggles, seething underneath their goggles as they looked at that person who they could see was looking at them with like disgust and why you're here, and feel what it was like to want to just rail off and punch that person in the face.
Yeah.
And we were so happy to be there that we sucked it up and we only talked about it amongst each other.
Yeah.
Not anymore.
No. It's crazy, man. In the end, I'm going with it will be good. And it might not be us. It might not be our kids. It might be our kids' kids.
Mm.
You know, but if we think about it, in the 50s, it was way worse than it is now, right? The past 5 years have reeled it back. Maybe this is like a slingshot. You know, you pull a slingshot back and it goes back and then you let the motherfucker go and it's zoom.
Yeah.
That's what I'm hoping for, because, I mean, it's gotten openly way worse.
Yeah. I'm hoping this last call.
Yeah, I would like the swastikas everywhere, and it's just like, whoa! It's not freedom of speech if you're a Nazi, right?
No.
It shouldn't be, because you were the enemy, and if you're the enemy and you got beat, you don't get freedom of speech. I mean, I might be wrong, but I think that's the way that one goes.
Bro, the slogan is literally, make America great again. Bro, they're out here trying to resurrect.
I mean, they're telling us what it is.
They're telling us what it is. And people are out here being like, guess what? We're going to get to be the 50s again in 2020. And it's, like you said, I hope it's the last hurrah. And if it's not us, our generation, or our kids' generation, at least they'll be able to say, hey, this is what they did to move things forward. This is the part that they played.
Yeah. Like, you know, maybe in our grandkids' generation, they'll show the cops, like, oh, cops used to be savage.
Like, wait, what? They used to ride around in tanks?
And just pull you over and whip you
And they have rocket launchers and shit? And they can
all of it.
Do whatever?
All of it. Yeah.
Yeah. How cool would that be?
Yeah, it'd be great. Time is something else. I never thought that I never thought this was going down like this.
If the writers came in to pitch this script at a studio, the studio head would look at them and be like, this is a lot.
It's too much.
Take that back, you know, shave 100 pages off of it and just something a little narrower focus.
Yeah.
If you're telling me we're going to endure a global pandemic and the largest civil rights movement, perhaps globally in history at the same time, I'm going to say, I don't know if the audience has the capacity to stomach all this.
That's a little bit much. That's 150 pages out of it. Well, sir, it's only 150 pages. Yeah. I'm going to have to start from zero on this one. And let's see something about a puppy dog getting lost that talks.
Yeah. Liven it up a bit.
Selena, always a good chat, man. Always
Russell, man. Chat. I love you, man.
I love you too, brother.
To be continued.
Yes, always. And I'm working something out for this spring at an undisclosed location.
Enough said. I'll just throw the bat.
Spencer about it, yeah.
Throw the bat signal in the air.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
We'll make it happen.
Yeah.
And down the line, you're going to have to come on the What Shapes This podcast.
Yeah, for sure. I'm down. You know I'm down.
All right, my brother.
Yeah, have a good day, Sal.
Stay up, Russell. Thank you, Vic.
For sure. One.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to come back next week for another episode of The Plug with Russell Winfield, brought to you by SIA Productions.